I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is January 26, 2026. The time is 3:31 p.m. So, today, members present, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Klayman, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Giesel. I believe that Senator Wilikowski will be along shortly. Two of the members are delayed today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Myers. They'll be joining us later. But we do have a quorum to conduct business. So thank you, Heather, who is keeping the records for us today, and Renzo and Doug, who are helping us out with the audio. Today we're continuing a presentation from Gaffney Klein on LNG. West Coast LNG, the various projects that are out there, the one that is being proposed for Alaska. And so today, their Senior Director of Gas, LNG, and Energy Transition, Mr. Nick Fulford, is online, and he is being joined by Andrew Duncan, Director of Facilities and Costs. Mr. Fulford was with us on Friday afternoon, and we didn't quite get through the PowerPoint, his PowerPoint presentation. We ended at slide 7. So we'll continue on with slide 8. I also have asked Mr. Fulford to discuss briefly the Wood Mackenzie report that was completed November 19th, 2024. It's entitled Economic Viability Assessment and Economic Value of Alaska LNG Project Phase 1. This is a report that we understand that Glenn Farn is referencing as a guide to what the state of Alaska would possibly be proposing in terms of tax reductions and things like that. So it would be very beneficial to this committee to have an overview of that report. We will at some point have Wood Mackenzie present it themselves, but I asked Mr. Fulford if he would be able to comment on some of the aspects of that Wood Mackenzie report. Let the record reflect that we are joined by Senator Wilikowski. So, Mr. Fulford, I see you online. Welcome. I will let you begin your presentation wherever you wish, if the Wood Mac, or we can continue on with slide 8 of your PowerPoint.
Thank you, Chair Giesel, and good afternoon, committee. I think with no further delay, I think it would be useful to proceed with the discussion around the Canadian projects. And as we move into the discussion about the framework and governance which may surround the newly configured AKLNG project, maybe we'll talk then about the Wood Mac report and where that sits. With that, let's talk about Canada to start with. And for the record, my name is Nicholas Fulford. Apologies, omitted that. I think the key thing for the committee and those watching to consider about Canada is that the fundamental economic model which drives LNG Canada, which is up and running, has been for a year or more, and the other development projects which exist there, the fundamental economic proposition is very, very similar to that which applies here in Alaska, in the sense that the project benefits from low-cost gas, which in the case of Canada comes, broadly speaking, from the Montney shale gas area, and low-cost shipping, which to all intents and purposes is identical to the shipping costs that would apply from Alaska. What both sets of projects have in common is typically a very long pipeline built across inhospitable terrain, which is arguably a more difficult pipeline environment in Canada than it is here in Alaska. So as you think about, well, what are the implications for Alaska? Well, I think one of the key implications is that with those projects south of the border, you have an investable project. You have one that is apparently profitable. And so it, in Clearly, the parallels aren't exact, but fundamentally, if it works in Canada, if LNG works in Canada, it could work in Alaska. So I think that's helpful to consider. On the graph here, you'll see a projection of the feed gas cost, which would go into the LNG Canada project. This is typically referred to as AECO or Station 1. It's a hub-based gas pricing approach, which is ultimately linked with U.S. wholesale gas prices in the south, but typically has a very significant discount on Henry Hub, which is the wholesale gas parameter that's usually used for Gulf Coast LNG. So you can see there that the projected cost of gas into those Canadian projects is about $2.50, $3. And as many of you will be aware from previous discussions, including the Woodmac report, a gas price for Alaska has been suggested in this sort of $1.25 range. So right from the get-go, you know, Alaska could benefit from a lower cost of gas than that which exists in Canada. But the Alaskan project has the disbenefit of having to construct a large and potentially costly gas processing plant. But as you think about the parallels, I think one of the reasons why it's useful to study these Canadian projects in more detail is because of those fundamental comparisons. Of note, LNG Canada, which, as I say, has been operating now for around a year and a bit. The second train came into operation over the summer. One of the equity owners of that project is an organization called Petronas, which is the state oil and gas company of Malaysia. They recently, they had a 25% equity stake. They recently sold 5% of that stake to a combination of a U.S. capital fund and Saudi Aramco. So as you think about the approach that the state of Alaska may take to the Alaskan project, it's worth considering that if that 25% stake option were executed, it's not necessarily in perpetuity. So, Petronas sold part of their interest, so could the state if it went forward in that mode. So just a point to remember. With that, I will move to the next slide, unless there are questions.
Yes, there is a question, Mr. Fulford. Senator Klayman.
Thank you. Just for purposes of the parallels, can you tell me where the LNG project is in Canada and how long a pipeline is involved? Because I think they're comparable, but that would help me to have a little bit more geographic reality.
Thank you, Senator Klayman, and through the chair. The LNG Canada project, and we'll go through some of this on the next slide, but the LNG Canada project, it's being built in Kitimat, about halfway down the British Columbia coast, and the pipeline has been built by TransCanada for the benefit of the LNG Canada project. I believe it's just over 400 miles, so it's shorter than the proposed pipeline from the slope. But, you know, as I say, slightly more hostile terrain.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman?
Thank you.
I see no further questions, Mr. Fulford.
Okay. I see the slide, I think, has gone on to the next one. Is a kind of a useful summary where things are. I've started on the top of the slide with a project. It's called the Tsilishims LNG project. And the reason I have that at the top there, two reasons really. One is that its development cycle is not dissimilar to where the project has reached in Alaska. Shell have signed up for a potential 2 million ton offtake. Total, another major LNG company, also signed up for 2 million tons plus equity. I think the remarkable thing about this project for the purposes of today's committee and people at home is that it's literally just a few hundred yards from the Alaskan border. It's right on the border between BC and Alaska. And as the crow flies, it's about 60 miles from Ketchikan. So it does kind of emphasize that this sort of Pacific coastline from from the slope really all the way down to Vancouver, it is quite an actively pursued area from an LNG perspective, and there are quite a few projects that could be developed. The other notable item about the Kasilishins project is that it's being pursued primarily by a group of First Nations and with the participation of a Houston-based infrastructure company and also some gas producers in northern British Columbia. The volume there is 12 million tons per annum, so not dissimilar from the Glen Farm proposal, and certainly significant. And perhaps, again, for the committee and the audience at home, rough numbers, today's LNG industry is around 400 million tons per annum in total. The growth projections generally accepted move it up to about 700 or even 800 million tons per annum. And most of that growth is coming from Asian markets. So that's another reason why these Pacific LNG projects are of particular interest. The ability to deliver into Asia is significantly more economic than, for example, for the Gulf Coast. So let's move on for a moment to LNG Canada. I mentioned that the first train of two trains, which come to 14 million tons per annum. The first of those trains started operation a year and a bit ago, the second one just a few months. So those vessels are currently being loaded and sailing into Asia, typically. Although, again, as a sort of an illustration of how fungible and dynamic the LNG market is these days, one of their ships, literally just a few days ago, was turned around, sent through the Panama Canal, and it's being delivered over in Europe. So it just a good illustration there, I think. On the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about LNG Canada and the fiscal construct which applies both from a provisional and from a federal standpoint. And, because again, I think that has some significance. There are two other projects, both smaller, Cedar LNG and Woodfibre as you go further south. The parallels with Alaska are not quite so marked, but nevertheless, it's a good example of two other projects that are making good progress and certainly they're well on their way to completion. So if there are no questions, I will move on to the next slide.
Mr. Fulford, I had a question. You mentioned on almost all of these, a term, formal stability mechanism. Could you elaborate on that meaning?
Yes, thank you, Chair Giesel. We've touched on it, I think, maybe in the earlier parts of this presentation, and I think Pegasus spoke about it as well on Friday, which is this question of fiscal stability, which, ultimately what we're talking about is a fiscal framework and government tax regime which an investor or a lender can depend on into the long term as these very large capital sums are recovered with these long-term tariffs. The LNG Canada project was the subject of considerable dialogue over 4 or 5 years with government. And in the sort of run-up to FID, the federal government gave the project what they called nation-building status. And part of that was it was sort of a broad assertion that the fiscal and tax framework around the project, with its status as a nation-building project, would not be changed. So while it fell short of a formal fiscal stability agreement, which you do find in LNG projects, the project developers, primarily Shell, and the major lenders behind the project took the view that that was enough of a fiscal guarantee to lower the risk around the investment and generally support the project. None of the other projects have that kind of framework just yet, but LNG Canada does, and that's what led to the comfort around fiscal stability.
Thank you. Senator Clayman has a question.
So when you're describing the fiscal stability for LNG Canada, it sounds like you're describing the fiscal stability from the government tax structure standpoint as opposed to internal analysis about the company's dollar analysis about whether this is going to work or not.
Thank you, Senator Clayman, through the chair. Yes, that's correct. The fiscal stability in this context is the tax framework around the project, both upstream and midstream. But of course, an investor in an LNG project is typically entirely exposed to, for example, LNG commodity prices, which may themselves be linked to oil prices. So, so in that sense, there is, you know, considerable risk on the part of the investor, but it's risks that they are comfortable with, as opposed to the risk of changes in government tax.
So, follow-up, Senator Clayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to the investor side, not the tax side, was LNG Canada disclosing more to the local governments or the provincial governments than we're seeing from Glenfarne?
That's an excellent question, Senator Clayman, through the chair. The degree of disclosure is not, broadly speaking, available publicly, but the evolution of the fiscal framework for LNG Canada took place over about 5 years, and during that time, the provincial government in particular changed their tax regime for the project very substantially. And as you'll see when we get on to that, the sort of front-end loading, in other words, taxes which apply from day one, were very considerably mitigated in favor of long-term revenue. So, given that amount of time and the dialogue which took place, I think it would be surprising if there wasn't a considerable degree of modeling and discussion around project economics.
I see no other questions, Mr. Fulford. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Giesel. I'll continue with the next slide. So, It's an interesting case study for AKLNG, given the similarities I've talked about. And the initial approach of the provincial government in British Columbia, who were presented with multiple major LNG project development proposals, was to, you know, take a high level examination of the, you know, gas prices which applied, you know, in the Montney of perhaps $2-3. And the landed prices, for example, in Japan, which appeared much higher. So there was an assumption that the project could sustain quite significant additional corporate income taxes. And so two bills were passed through the BC Parliament, one relating to an LNG tax the other relating to kind of framework agreements, which applied. In the event, both those taxes were repealed. So in the period from the start of the dialogue to the end, there was not only a repealing of these additional taxes which had been produced, but a tax credit was introduced for corporate income tax. It effectively reduced the rate of tax, corporate income tax, from about 12% to around 9%. So it's now very similar to that which would apply in Alaska. There was a deferment of provincial sales tax. Obviously, sales tax doesn't apply quite in the same way in Alaska. But it's useful as you think about the dialogue around property tax, for example. The value of the sales tax deferment was about $450 million. That's effectively a sort of a 20-year interest-free loan. So the province will collect that money in the long term, but obviously with no interest and significantly delayed. On the federal side, the major contribution to avoid that sort of front-end loading was accelerated depreciation. So taxes were alleviated quite considerably in the short term, but then obviously kicked in the long term. Interestingly, we talked on Friday of property tax in Louisiana, Texas, and indeed in Maryland. So property tax does apply in Canada and Kitimat, but it's orders of magnitude less than it is in Alaska. So LNG Canada, I think, pays a rising property tax, which started at around $2 million per annum in the first year of construction. I think it's up to about $10 million. This is Canadian dollars currently. And it will move to, it's essentially a PILT currently. And it'll move to conventional property tax in about 2035, I think, in which case it could be a little higher. But in a way, their approach to provincial sales tax was a little bit like what appears to be being requested on the property tax side in Alaska. The other things actually to remark on, carbon tax. Obviously, Alaska doesn't have a carbon tax. British Columbia does. It's a fairly significant element of provincial policy, but it was capped at a relatively low level for perpetuity. So again, it's a much less significant feature for them to consider. So as we move forward, it may be worth doing a much more rigorous analysis around LNG Canada and the different taxes that apply, but for today's hearing, I think that's maybe a helpful summary.
Mr. Fulford, Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this point, we've heard that there might be a request for property tax changes. We haven't seen a bill yet, at least that I can recall. I think this is probably something we'll spend quite a bit of time on, though, if such a request comes. But I'm curious in Canada, a couple things. Number one, was the gas line and LNG export facility built by an independent producer similar to what's being suggested here? And who requested the tax breaks? What was the bottleneck? Was it tax breaks to produce gas? Was it tax breaks to build the line, the LNG plant? What was the holdup that required tax breaks?
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Interestingly, back in 2013, when this initial dialogue started, Petronas were actually pursuing a separate LNG project to LNG Canada, which is being pursued by Shell and Mitsubishi primarily. But both companies were quite vocal in their feedback to both provincial and federal government, which is that under the tax regime that would have applied, especially with these additional LNG taxes, the projects were uninvestable and would not move ahead. And so for quite a few years, there was a kind of an impasse where the developers insisted that the tax arrangements predominantly for the LNG exporting entity as opposed to the upstream would need to be significantly amended for those projects to go ahead. And really in the 2017-18 timeframe, arguably a bigger push from federal government to encourage LNG exports into the Pacific, and equally a more enlightened view perhaps within the provincial government, that's when these concessions were made. So, and incidentally, the BC tax and royalty mechanism for the upstream hasn't really changed at all throughout this whole dialogue. Obviously, there have been amendments and tweaks, but fundamentally, the upstream wasn't touched, and it was essentially the corporate income tax and carbon tax that was the focus. But to answer the first part of your question, LNG Canada was primarily Shell. The other major competing project was Petronas in Malaysia, who had already acquired a Canadian upstream producing gas company. So they'd already acquired, if you like, the gas to put into the LNG project, but they just needed to build the liquefaction. So in the end, in the last stages of LNG Canada, Petronas essentially abandoned their projects and threw their equity in with Shell and Mitsubishi and KOGAS into LNG Canada.
Yes, Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this presentation. Continuing on with Canada LNG, how much, and I know it's not exactly analogous, it's 400 miles, our project will be significantly longer, but what ended up being the all-in cost for LNG Canada, and who paid for it? So you're mentioning Shell leading the way, but was it privately financed? Did the government also provide, besides from these tax benefits, did they provide direct capital into the project?
Thank you, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. The pipeline was built primarily by TransCanada, and they entered into a arm's length negotiation or a contract with the LNG Canada sponsors, the lead of which would be Shell, to build the pipeline and essentially collect a tariff on it. So unlike the broader implications of phase one in Canada, in Alaska, sorry, which involve supplying gas to, gas and power customers in South Central, there was no real state involvement in LNG Canada, and no particular guarantees or concessions were given by the provincial government or indeed the federal government to any of those stakeholders. So cost escalation risk, which turned out to be quite significant with the Coastal GasLink pipeline. I think there was almost a doubling in the actual cost of construction versus the budget. But that was all absorbed by the on the one hand by TransCanada, one imagines, and equally by Shell. And the way that cost overrun was treated will have been pre-negotiated.
Follow up,
Senator Dunbar.
Doubled to what? What did it end up costing? 40 billion? Yeah. 50 billion?
I I used to have this number at my fingertips, and apologies, I've misplaced the number. It could have been 11 billion for 22 Canadian dollars, but I'll be able to check on that in just a moment.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
But I guess that 11, if let's say it's 22 billion, that's just for the pipeline, not an LNG facility. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was just the pipeline. So the LNG facility would have been more. I think the cost of the LNG side of the equation would have been about 20 billion US. That's based on the sort of accepted range of construction cost for LNG liquefaction.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kosaki.
Thank you. So when the discussion about the property taxes has come up, I looked at some old records, like an old Wood Mac PowerPoint slide, and it talks about Louisiana and Texas being or having a typical property tax rate between 0 and 0.5%, and it says Alaska's LNG would be at the 0.2% or 20 mils. Then I'm looking at Canada, particularly Alberta and Saskatchewan, and their tax rate appears to be somewhere between 0.5 and 2.5%, or 50 mil and 250 mil. Are you saying that that's incorrect, or there were some other changes that were made to the tax system specifically for that project?
Excuse me, Senator Kawasaki. I wonder if you could just repeat the question.
The question is that I'm looking at these tax rates because we were told that we're going to get a bill on tax rates at some point in time to zero them out, and I'm looking at the tax rates in Canada and in particular Saskatchewan and Alberta for oil property taxes is between 0.5% and 2.5%, which is 50 mil to 250 mil. So my question is there, am I getting the wrong information from somewhere?
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki, and through the chair. I'm not familiar with we're talking property tax rates here, I think. I'm not familiar with how they work in those provinces. In BC, the example I gave, the sole beneficiary of property taxes is the Kitimat city, which is one of the reasons why the numbers are so much lower. But in terms of mill rate, I'm not sure how those would apply. And if I may quickly follow up on Senator Dunbar's question, the number is a little less than I had remembered. The initial estimate for the Coastal GasLink pipeline was 6.6 billion Canadian, and the eventual cost was 14.4. So thank you, just to clarify that.
And
Senator Kawasaki, follow up.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. And just to clarify, so the current petroleum property tax rate in the state is 20 mils or 0.2%. And I was just comparing that to what I've read is the current fiscal regime in Saskatchewan and Alberta, where oil tax is closer to 0.5 and 2.5%.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. As I say, that may well be correct. I'm not aware of property tax arrangements in those provinces and how they apply to oil and gas. Okay. I could follow up on that if you wish.
Sure.
That would be helpful. Mr. Fulford, Senator Myers has a question now.
Thank you. Mr. Fulford, at the time that they hit FID for LNG Canada, let's see if I'm understanding your previous slide correctly. There, the initial plan was 14 million tons per year. At the time of FID, how much of that was under take or pay binding contracts?
Thank you, Senator Myers. Actually, that's a very interesting observation. The answer is all of it, because LNG Canada operates under what is typically termed an equity marketing arrangement. So each of the equity partners in the project, that would be Shell, Mitsubishi, KOGAS, Petronas, the parent company of each of those entities, or at least an LNG trading entity, signed up for basically 100% of their entitlement. And so in effect, the sort of credit risk for the project was passed entirely back into the parent company's balance sheet. And it's a very convenient and effective way of financing LNG projects, because typically lenders will look at that and they'll look at the credit worthy entities on the end of it, and they will offer relatively low cost finance.
I see no further questions. Mr. Fulford, you can move on to the next slide or complete your comments on that slide.
I think, as I say, LNG Canada is perhaps an example to look at in more detail, but for today, let's move on. So let's look at the comparison with the previous projects. And if I may, Senator Giesel, I'm going to deal with the second slide first, which relates to the SB 138 sort of project concept versus what's being dealt with currently.
Mr. Fulford, Mr. Fulford, just one moment. So for the audience listening, that's slide 14. Go ahead, Mr. Fulford.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Yes, I think the this question around project structure warrants a few minutes before we go back to the question of both, you know, the Woodmac report indirectly, and the broader questions around the roadmap from here. And there's one fundamental difference between what was contemplated 10 years ago and what's being contemplated now, and that is that, in effect, one of the advantages of the SB 138 concept, if I can call it that, was the completely integrated and aligned nature of all the parties as you move down the supply chain from production right down to producing LNG. And the entire concept hinged around the state's entitlement to gas through royalty in kind and taxes gas. And obviously, there was never a final determination as to whether those options would be triggered. But ultimately, there was a general understanding, I think, that if they were, it would create roughly a 25% equity interest for the state all the way down through the pipeline and through the LNG. And effectively, the state would have contributed capital along with the other stakeholders in exactly the same proportion. The key feature, though, is that for that concept, that there never was going to be a kind of a transfer price at the upstream. So as the gas moves from essentially from the well right down through the pipeline to the liquefaction, the only point at which that gas was valued would be ultimately when the LNG leaves Nikiski. As I say, it had a lot of elegance to it, but one of the features that was essentially removed from that equation by the state taking taxes, gas, and royalty in kind was the sales price. The concept that exists today, as I understand it, so we move from an integrated structure on the left-hand diagram to a merchant structure on the right. And obviously with that move and with that change of concept, gas is being sold by various stakeholders potentially into the project, and there will indeed be a transfer price. And for example, in the Woodmac report, that transfer price was nominally estimated at a dollar, just I think for illustrative purposes. with a note that there could be $1.25 variable, particularly if the gas came from Point Thompson. So a couple of things. First of all, that has implications for the state because obviously with there being a transfer price at the upstream, that there will also be a tax and royalty generated. And the other feature, which would warrant, I think, further investigation as time goes on, is that depending on how the profitability within the LNG plant or within the LNG scheme is allocated between the upstream and the midstream, the government take changes as well. So as a general rule of thumb, the more LNG profitability that's transferred into the upstream through a higher transfer price, the greater the state tax take would be. So that element of the dialogue around where profit resides didn't, it wasn't a material feature of the old LNG project, but it will be in the new one. And it's, as the project continues, it's something to consider. So as I say, happy to take questions on that. But with that, I see a question from Senator Wilkowski.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this slide and what you just testified to really hits on a core question that we as a legislature have will need your guidance from. And that is, has this project morphed into something materially different than what was contemplated in Senate Bill 138 back in 2014, such that it needs updated legislative direction? And if so, what would you as our consultant recommend?
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Obviously, there's a lot in that question, which I'm sure we'll develop and pursue in the coming weeks. But I think you're correct in saying that this slide speaks to a material difference in structure between the SB 138 concept and the ones on the table now. And you know, even the issue which I alluded to briefly, which is that the government take will change depending on how profit is allocated between upstream and midstream. Even that, I think, requires a fresh look at how the state may wish to approach the question of taxation for the LNG project. And I think there could be a number of changes recommended from how the project was being looked at 10 years ago.
Further questions on this slide? Seeing none, Mr. Fulford, were you going to go back now to slide 13?
Yes, thank you, Chair Giesel. I think, you know, with that introduction to the change, I think it's perhaps makes more sense now to think about what the you know, what the questions would be and what the comparisons would be. So Senate Bill 138 it called for heads of agreement and subsequently much more detailed arrangements between the stakeholders, which could have transpired had the project continued. But, you know, as you look back to what was agreed, there are a number of key sections, I think, which warrant further consideration. First of all, you know, who are now the appropriate parties to any kind of framework agreement? Is it purely the LNG development company? Does it include the upstream companies or not? And you know, other questions of that sort, which, you know, have a material effect on how things unfold. The enabling legislation, which may be needed to put these things into effect, again, could change markedly. And, you know, I think following up on Senator Wilkowski's remarks, production tax and royalty insofar as they impact on the upstream may warrant further examination given the way in which profit will flow to the state through taxes. And then the other features which will clearly be material and were essentially envisaged in the previous heads agreement, which was agreed, is the pricing of gas, obviously, to Alaskans as part of the phase one. And, you know, another feature which was baked into the HOA that applied between the original four partners, and this is the Jobs for Alaskans and Alaskan Hire Agreement. Clearly, in last week's announcements, which obviously I think everyone's still taking in, there were a number of undertakings around local employment. In fact, a number of Alaskan companies involved with that. But all the same, it stops short, I think, of what was in the original HOA. The other feature which had begun to be defined under SB 138 and the HOA is the way in which gas could be used within the state, so-called low-cost gas, and obviously the fundamental question of state participation and indeed supply points for the interior. These were all things that were dealt with in some detail in the original heads of agreement, which would have to be re-examined and reintroduced, I think, but with this different framework in mind. So I think this will be the governing framework and the contractual terms which evolve over the next few months. They will clearly involve a lot of material considerations for the state as well as the private investors. So I'll pause there.
Well, while committee members are pondering your last statements, I'll make a comment. These are the kinds of things that we've been considering as we've seen statements from Glenn Farn. And of course, it raises the question of how they could have reached agreements from buyers and contractors and not known what the state of Alaska would be asking for in answering these questions on this slide. There was nothing that I saw in the public announcements about a project labor agreements, for example. It was nothing there about the supply of gas to Fairbanks. We know there's probably a takeoff point, but what about the pipe that goes from that takeoff point to the city of Fairbanks? How will that be financed? I mean, these are all open questions that the average Alaskan who saw this project before would be asking. So this slide is very relevant. Any other questions from committee members on this slide? All right, I'll let you move on, Mr. Fulford.
Okay, thank you, Chair Giesel. So at this point, I'll pause and say a few words about the WoodMac report that you referred to, which deals with the economics of the project.
Before you go forward, Mr. Fulford, pause for just a moment. For members of the public, that report will be found under the documents section for this committee meeting today. It has been publicly posted. Go ahead, Mr. Fulford.
Okay, thank you, Chair Giesel. For people referring to that report, on page 13, you will see a reference to a fairly significant economic breakdown of particularly how the gas line phase one tariffs could work and the sensitivity to different things. And a number of these assumptions speak to features of taxation on which the state will wish to have an opinion and essentially change or not change as it feels appropriate. One of the significant ones on there is on about the fourth line of the of that sheet, which people can refer to. There's a reference to property tax, which moves the nominal mill rate from 20 mills down to 2 mills. So it's a 90% reduction in property tax, which applies across the economic projection. So as Chair Giesel has mentioned, I believe this is something that Glenn Farn have referenced as well. But I'm not aware of any analysis or indications from government that would necessarily be a valid assumption, whether it's state government or municipalities. So my understanding is that this has been simply an assumption that was put there for the purposes of an economic illustration. And I certainly have nothing more that I can add to that by way of whether it's a valid assumption or not as things go forward. So I suspect that's an area which will require some discussion. As I said on Friday at the discussion, there was a lot of work done following SB 138 on a PILT, but nothing was ever enacted or formally proposed. Did I hear a question, Chair Giesel?
I'm not seeing one, no.
Okay. So the other features of this analysis, you know, one of them relates to the period over which the gas pipeline would be depreciated. There's a relatively long depreciation life offered up to 2071. So there are sensitivities there regarding an earlier potential economic termination and the implications that would have. But fundamentally, the tariff, which would apply through the pipeline and the assumptions which have the greatest effect are essentially the property tax and, you know, the cost sensitivity and other features. The other element of tax uncertainty, well, not directly tax, but relates to the federal loan guarantee, which as we've noted previously, makes quite a significant difference to the project economics, but remains to be seen whether that will be available or not. So in summary, I think the WoodMac economic analysis is a robust analysis based on the assumptions that are set out in the paper, but I'm not aware of any correlation between that and any agreement or indications provided by state government.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Fulford? Okay, it is my intention to have WoodMac actually come and go through this report in more detail with us. So if members would just look it over, consider questions. All right, Mr. Fulford, looks like we're ready to go back to your slide deck, slide 15.
Okay, thank you, Chair Giesel. At this point, I will hand over to my colleague, Andrew Duncan, who is well qualified, I think, to talk about this topic. And I'll let him guide you through the slides.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Duncan.
Thank you very much, Nick and Chair Giesel. For the record, my name is Andrew Duncan. I'm dialing in from the Gaffney Klein Singapore office. Today, I'm talking about the pathway to a final investment decision for large material projects. These slides were prepared prior to the Glenn Farn announcement. That doesn't undermine their relevance, but it does, let's say, color my approach to the presentation to take into account what I think Glenn Farn are doing and how they are progressing the project. So if we could have the next slide, pardon me, slide 17. So to take a final investment decision, and I'm emphasizing the final of final investment decision, that being the decision to proceed with the the high capex, high expenditure part of the project, as opposed to preparatory phases, which I'll come back to in a second. Just recognize a few features of the Alaska LNG project that are unique to this project, and of course every major project has got its own distinguishing features. As you know, we have a phase one which transports pipeline gas to the state domestic market. We have low gas availability risks, or low subsurface risk, with the gas volumes that will supply the project being to a great extent proven. And facilities capital costs are a large and dominant part of this project. A final investment decision package will need to provide coverage to all the project work streams before commitment to proceed into the execution of the project. Next slide, please. As a bit of background on, let's call it, project management theory, a project final investment decision is typically reached through a stage gate process. And a generic stage gate process is illustrated here on the slide. And essentially, it's a series of project activities interspersed with what are termed decision gates. So it's a point where the project proponents and the project governance system take a look at where the project is and take a conscious decision to proceed to the next stage of the project. And that may well be linked to a funding decision to proceed to the next stage of the project. It could include some contingencies that be willing to proceed to the next stage, but dependent on certain other activities. At each gate, at each stage of the project, the full scope of the project is reviewed in the level of detail that it's available at that time. And that's not only the project technical scope, but also looks at the cost and schedule of the project, the organizational aspects of the project, so how it's going to be executed, project management team, project governance, and so forth. Of particular relevance here is the legal, permitting, fiscal, and regulatory framework is needs to be in place. Obviously, the commercial framework, how the project is going to make money, and which leads through to the financing framework as where the capital to execute the project is going to come from, and whether the project is significantly robust to support the lending arrangements. And finally, and by all means not lowest in priority, is stakeholder management. And for a project like Alaska LNG, which will have a transformational effect on the state economy. Stakeholder management probably should be at the top of the list rather than the bottom. There are a lot of people interested in this project, and there will be a strong thread of information flow and let's call it political management to support progress of the project. Next slide, please.
Before you go on, Mr. Duncan, let's pause for a moment.
Sorry.
Committee members, any questions? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. The front page of the Anchorage Daily News today says Alaska LNG says it expects to start laying pipe as early as December. Does that seem realistic under this framework, this FID? We're hearing FID decisions are imminent. What's your assessment of that?
Okay. Now, when I look at the wording of the Glenfarne announcement, I do see a lot of conditionality in it. There are conditional awards. There are provisional commitments, and that's quite normal for the early stages of a large project. In my next couple of slides, I will take a look at where I think they are based on the public domain information. But just to talk about building project momentum in the early stages of a project, there is a lot that can be done to prepare for a project and to build momentum, which is useful to the eventual execution of the project, but let's say is relatively low cost in comparison to the total project cost. And you often see this in large projects. And I'm thinking, for example, of construction site works, so things like access roads, work camps, and things like that. So the site temporary works. Glenfarne have made an announcement around the supply of steel, and I think that kind of a securing supply of key long lead items is prudent. Of course, I haven't seen the details of those orders, but an appropriate risk management approach might be to include cancellation clauses in those orders in the event that the project doesn't go ahead, but still to start to align suppliers to the idea of having to supply these materials when they are required. Glenfarne have also secured or built the early stages of contractual relationships with a number of construction companies. And again, that's a prudent approach to start to signal mobilization of resources and to start to engage with companies to get them to be thinking about how to mobilize the resources to execute the project. So there seems to be a lot of things going on that are constructive and are being actioned in order to secure the schedule of the project while limiting the risk to to the parties of the agreement. Whether pipe lay can start in December, I would need to take a more thorough look at the project to comment on that. I have seen certainly Glenfarne are able to move things along, and I think what is more critical than a start of a certain activity is being able to see the pathway through to successful completion of the project in a let's say sort of a structured way of having a thorough look at the project, and that we know how the project is going to be completed before we start significant commitments to commencing the project.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski. So, Mr. Duncan, as I look at the project management framework that you've laid out here, it looks very much like what we heard from the industrial megaprojects author. So you point out the decision gates along this continuum. At what decision gate do you perceive Glenfarne being at?
Okay. I will touch on that in a couple of slides, but quickly, I think they are probably between DG2 and DG3, but with a forward plan through to the development phase, which they certainly haven't shared publicly, but I would expect that they know where they're going.
So thank you for that. So final investment decision, again, I'm recalling back to the industrial megaproject presentations that we had in the previous project, appeared to occur at decision gate 4. When class 3 level cost estimates were solidified. Is that somewhat accurate?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay. Thank you. Let me see if there's any other questions. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. And I don't know if you can clarify this or not, but we've heard a lot about a notice to proceed. And I'm wondering where exactly a notice to proceed in what stage gate is that? Because go ahead.
The notice to proceed will relate to a set of project activities that are the subject of that notice. And if the project developer is acting to safeguard the project schedule and to carry out the early works on long lead items or early preparatory works, a notice to proceed could be issued very early on in the project, provided the activities that a notice to proceed relates to are contributory to the final version of the project. And I have seen notice to proceeds on major projects issued when the scope of the final project really wasn't known, but the resources that were needed to go into the project were clear, and the project developer had confidence that the project was going to proceed, but they didn't just quite know exactly what it was going to look like at this stage. In this case, there is quite an extensive call it project definition scope, which is available on the Alaska Pipeline public website, so it's available in public domain. And you know, talking about pipeline routes, pipeline right of way, there's an extensive amount of permitting and regulatory work that's been done. And you know, we also know that Glenn Farne have had quite some time to mature the project further based on that preparatory work that they inherited when they took over the project. We see from their public announcement that they have been focusing on securing construction resources, making preliminary agreements with gas suppliers. So they have been taking useful action to progress the project. But there does seem to be an assumption within that the project will go ahead. So I can see the framework that they are acting within. So far, I haven't seen anything that I would consider to be inappropriate. Much of what they're doing is building momentum with the project and taking the early steps for execution phase. As I said earlier, whether that's going to lead to a start of full-scale pipeline in December, I think that a more detailed scope and readiness review would be better positioned to comment on that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Duncan. I see no other questions on this slide. I'll let you move on to slide 19.
Okay. On slide 19, we've seen references to cost estimate class, and I just wanted to let's say provide a bit of the basis as to where this nomenclature comes from, and a first pass assessment of where we might be based on the public domain information available. So there's an association called the American Association of Cost Engineers, and they produce a range of standards around cost estimation framework. The one illustrated here is related to pipeline transportation and infrastructure, and I would say it's the appropriate standard to cover this project. Next slide, please, slide 20. Now, within that document, there is a table of cost estimate classes, and these range from class 5, which is a screening level estimate. You might call it a rule of thumb. And typically, those that are on pipelines, those are estimates that are driven by concepts like dollars per inch mile and things like that. And then the estimate class gradually moves from class 5 to 4 to 3 based on the amount of detailed engineering work that supports that estimate. And as we mentioned earlier, typically a final investment decision is taken on a class three estimate. Where are we now? Graphically, it's shown here as a rhetorical question. But in the next slide, I attempt to answer that. Just one more point on this on slide 20 before we leave it. In the bottom right, the estimate classes are shown related to sort of a graphical illustration of the uncertainty range in the estimate. And the basic concept is that as you mature the estimate, the amount of uncertainty in both cost and schedule reduces, and associated with that uncertainty is the level of contingency that you might like to carry in the estimate to carry you through to startup of the project. May I move on to the next slide, or were there questions?
I see no questions, Mr. Duncan.
Okay, let's move to slide 21 then, please. Okay, again, from the same document, which is available online, I've pulled up their project input checklist, and I stress that I've tried to summarize where we are based on the public domain information that I have. And that's primarily the Alaska LNG website. And as I mentioned earlier, there has been a lot of information, a lot of work done on pipeline routing, pipeline right of way, and permits and regulatory work. And that work is sound, thorough work, provided that's what is going to be executed at the end of the day. If the project survives in its current scope, and there's no reason to think that it won't, then all this work on right of way and routing is useful and contributes to the final project. So what I've done here is I've just taken a first pass guess at where the project is on these various aspects of the project technical scope. I won't go through each in detail, but where it generally points to is a robust class five, early class four estimate. Although the AACE framework doesn't talk very much about the commercial and financing basis of a project, it is focusing mainly on the technical definition of the project. If we could move to slide 22, please.
Yes.
Okay, slide 22 is continuation of slide 21, and it's again a review of the AAC's input checklist. It leads to the conclusion that based on the public domain, the current status is robust class five, early class four. But I do stress that this is not a comprehensive review of project readiness. I used to do project readiness reviews for a living, so I know what a comprehensive review looks like. But I do endorse the comments the open questions and the recommendations from that Pegasus presented in their presentation last week. And I think we're both talking from the same song sheet.
Very good. Mr. Duncan, Senator Myers has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir. So, Mr. Duncan, looking at these two slides together here, I mean, I'm a little bit concerned here. So, you know, they're telling us that they think they can have an FID by the, I think it was end of March last we heard. And, you know, so if we're supposed to be at class three at that point, you know, I would expect to look at what you're circling here and say, oh, okay, you know, half of it be class three, half of it be class four, something along those lines. And, but you're circling most of it in class five and what I'm just saying, maybe a third of it or so in class four. That concerns me a little bit. And I think they're, I'm hearing from, you know, what we've seen from Glenn Farning, kind of some, a few public statements. It sounds like they think they're a little bit further along than what you're indicating here, but I'm trying to figure out if you're, what's more likely is, mm-hmm. is your guesstimate off, or are they just not nearly as far along as they're leading us to believe?
Yes, through the chair, Senator, you're quite correct that, my, guesstimate, is based on the public domain information that was posted on the Alaska LNG website, and it just primarily relates to the body of work that Glenn Farne inherited when they first took over the project. Now, I am confident that Glenn Farne have matured that work in the meantime, and they are certainly further ahead than what I've circled here. We know from public domain that they have carried out a costing review with Worley, who are a very credible engineering and project management company. The results of that costing review have not been made public, so I can't comment on that. I stress this is number one, not a comprehensive review, and number two, it is somewhat backward looking based on what's in the public domain.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. And maybe you said this and I just missed it, but can you, am I understanding this correct? Where at the top, it says maturity level of project, and then class five is 0 to 2%, class four is 1 to 15%. And then you've got some circles there, and it does that mean if it's class four that it's 15% complete, between 1 and 15% complete?
Okay. Thanks for the question, and through the chair, this is the 0 to 15% is the percentage of engineering definition as opposed to the percentage of project completion.
Can you explain that? I don't understand.
Okay.
I'm not an engineer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the full project will include a technical engineering phase at the front end to define what is going to be built. Then it will include a procurement phase where the project materials are purchased, line pipe and so forth, and then a construction phase where the project is actually constructed. Typically, the engineering phase of the project could be, 5, 8, 10% of the total project cost. And these percentages relate to the completion of the engineering work. Now, the way I've expressed it is as sequential phases, which of course they are not. The project phases overlap with each other. So the engineering definition will progress along the early stages of procurement and indeed mobilization for construction. And a key part of project management is to keep all those activities contributing to the same final scope and progressing in a way that the deliverables of the early phases are available for the later phases to begin on time.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
Yes, I apologize if I'm the only one not getting this, but can you give me, can we walk through one here? There's technical deliverables, there's hydraulic design, you've got S, P on class four, and then you got CCC. So you're saying you think you're at class four. I don't know what S means, I don't know what P means, I don't know what C means, I don't know what D means. What do those things mean?
Okay, so P is preliminary, NR is not required, and P stroke C or C in that is that the deliverable is completed, and S is started, so it means that the work has commenced.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions on these two slides? Some of it is a little bit, somewhat explained a bit more on slide 20, where the classes are somewhat described a little bit. The coding, of course, wasn't. I appreciate your question, Senator Wilikowski, the S, the P, the NR. But you can see how the AACE cost estimate classes detail a bit there. Needless to say, the underlying message here is it's complicated, a bit more complicated than perhaps just press releases. But that's my comment. Any further questions, Senator Myers?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So, the question is kind of, a little bit of what stage are we at, and we're hoping we're rapidly approaching FID. So the question is, if we're not as far along as we think we are, but we still have a FID made here, let's say in March, obviously the major concern, the major risk is potential massive cost overrun at some point. Are there any other risks besides that that we need to take into account?
Hand in hand with cost overrun, of course, goes schedule overrun. The other risks that are associated with, incomplete project definition or particularly schedule overrun, and Pegasus also alluded to these, are together with schedule overrun, some of the enabling permits and so forth they may be time limited permitting, so they might need to be renewed. And conditional project awards. So let's say conditional awards for material supply, conditional awards for construction services, those kind of agreements may also include a time factor that sets a limit on the validity of those agreements related to time. So there are associated risks, but they all tend to ramp up to cost and schedule risks. And related to that, of course, is project credibility. So if a project is initiated and then stalls for whatever reason, then there is a confidence building measure that would need to be gone through to remobilize and to re-implement the project.
Thank you. Mr. Duncan, I'm going to address the committee now for a moment. We're at 5 p.m., which is our usual adjournment time. Mr. Duncan, of course, still taking questions on those two slides. There's two more left. Is the committee okay with continuing?
Yeah.
Looks okay. Mr. Duncan, do you have time to continue the discussion a bit longer?
Certainly, I do.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I was going to mention that. I'm not sure what time it is in Singapore, but thank you for being here with us. So my question is actually about the next two slides, which are not up on our screens right now, but have to do with pre-FID and measures to assure FID. But what I wanted to know as we approach those two slides, or as we discuss them, what do you actually mean when you say FID? What are we talking about? Are we talking about like FID in late March? Does that mean there will be an investment decision and an announcement where they say, here are our investors, or will it be more like what you describe, I think you're describing on slide 24, where it's saying, here is our proposal for investors to invest in, and here is the support package. And if that's the case, is FID more a process than a moment, and how long does that process typically take?
Well, okay, there's a lot in that question, through the chair. A final investment decision, what it actually entails, and whether it's a process or a succinct document varies a lot by the management processes of the project sponsor. I have seen final investment decisions where they are signaled by a letter from the project operator to the project joint venture partners, almost a legal document, which says, you know, against this background, we have agreed to take a final investment decision to a project of this scope. And it's very succinct. It's very detailed and thorough in its description. And that is the sort of classic project final investment decision where everybody can point to a document and a date that says that's when it happened. At the other end of the scale, you have the typically fast track projects, which are managed by a series of commitments to, as I said earlier, mobilize resources to contribute to the final implementation of the project. And that would be more described as a progressive FID or a final investment decision process. And against that kind of a background, the decision is made over a period of time, and the commitment to the final scope and final implementation of the project could well be taken a number of years after the initial stages of the project are commenced. Sometimes those extended processes are driven by outside effects, changes in geopolitics, changes in commercial framework, and any number of things. But the key part is that the project manager behind the project is managing those activities and managing the scope of the activities and the commitment within the activities to contribute to the final project scope without unnecessary and wasted investment. An example of that might be a project which is broken into phases, where an initial phase might contribute to the initial objective of the project. Let's say, for example, Alaska domestic gas supply, and the later phases of the project, compression stations, LNG plant, contribute to a later development of the project, but that the decisions taken in the early stages of the project are consistent with the final scope. And yeah, it takes a great deal of project management skill to keep a project like that on track and keep all the activities aligned with a view to the long-term objective. So that was a long way of saying that a final investment decision can be a process, or it can be a distinct point in time. And I think it's it would be useful, and again, this is echoing something that Pegasus have said, it would be useful to thoroughly review what this process is and exactly where we are at the moment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Duncan. You know, I reflect back on your slide 18, where you call out the framework of pre-FID, and one of the bullet points is stakeholder management, which you alluded to would be the state of Alaska. And the project is proceeding without having secured the stakeholder engagement, which would, of course, affect regulatory frameworks, legal issues, cost with taxes, and so forth. So, yes, it must be proceeding as a process, though that seems like a very risky way to proceed. Are we on slide? I think Senator Dunbar moved us to slide 23. Is there anything further you wanted to cover on slide 23 or 24, Mr. Duncan?
So just casting my eye over slide 23, I think we've discussed many of the aspects there. We've talked about the duration of the pre-FID phase. So I don't see any points to add on that. Perhaps if we may skip to slide 24.
All right, we're there.
Yep. So we've touched on stakeholder management and transparency, which is clearly a critical issue. I just want to add a final word on uncertainty management and the techniques that are available to manage that within a project management framework. At any stage of a project, a cost and schedule risk analysis can be carried out. And the techniques that are available to do that, they're generally attempt to quantify the risks and uncertainties in the project and the impact that those uncertainties could have on the final cost and schedule outcome of the project. And the results of those kind of reviews are expressed in terms of a probability distribution in cost and schedule. And typically, project sponsors, project developers will use those to assess the financial provisions that they need to make to ensure that the project can be carried through to completion. And what the technical cost estimate usually provides is a base estimate. So that's the cost of the known components of the project. And then based on those risk assessments, a level of contingency is applied to bring the cost estimate up to generally a 50-50 estimate. Or indeed, if you're talking to a party that wants an even higher degree of assurance around the estimate, and that typically might be a bank or a lender, then contingency is allocated to bring the estimate up to a higher level of assurance. And I raised this partly to identify that these techniques are available and that there are mechanisms to deal with uncertainty. And that, you know, those kind of techniques are baked into project management processes. So I think with that, that's the end of my remarks. If there are further questions.
Yes, Senator Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was handed a note that it's a little after 10 in the morning tomorrow in Singapore. So I hope Tuesday is nice. So I understand from your remarks that, you know, FID is both a sort of decision, which is a singular action, and also a process, much like light is both a, you know, a particle and a wave. I can accept that. But what I really want to know is, should we expect in March, if they reach FID, that we will understand where the money is coming from? That to me is the central question in all of this, is where is the finance actually coming from? So should we expect if they go to FID in March, they will say, here are the financial commitments, you know, the loans we have secured or the investments that have been made by I think it would be private entities at this point. Should we expect that in March if they go to FID in March?
Through the chair. Sorry.
Yes, please, Mr. Duncan.
Yeah. I would expect there to be certainly clear guidance on where funds or guarantees of funds are coming from. Typically, financial provisions are defined subject to a final investment decision being taken. So the financing processes and the final investment decision processes are linked. And that is particularly true where the project developer is seeking to fund the project from borrowed money. If the project is funded off the proponent's own balance sheet, then they have a bit more flexibility. But implicit in that is who is taking the risk of cost overruns, and in that context, there also needs to be a strong understanding of who is carrying what risks in the project. I alluded in slide 24 to a range of risk management mechanisms that are available. At final investment decision, it should be clear how the project is going to be funded, and the project risk and allocation of risk should also be addressed at that point. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Duncan?
Just on that.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. So how will a company know what the actual costs are without knowing something like what the state's tax is going to be at that point? Or will that just be put into the somewhere in the risk category of the decision making at FID?
This comes back to the fiscal stability mechanisms that that Nick was speaking of earlier. The final commercial structure of the project, of course, will need to include the tax structuring, as well as obviously costs and sales revenue. The project developer may decide to accept some fiscal risk. I think Nick alluded to this on the Canada LNG project, where there were some initial undertakings on fiscal stability, which perhaps fell short of an ironclad agreement, but there was, you know, sort of directionally an undertaking which was acceptable for the project proponents and the project lenders. So it would be a question of what risks, whether the project developer is willing to accept those particular risks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Klayman.
On the same topic about risks and guarantees, and if we're particularly looking at the lenders, much of what Glenfarne is doing is confidential, and we don't get to see it. But it seems to me that even in the world of private lenders, if the lending for the project is all coming from private lenders and not some public entity, that too ends up being something that we, the legislature, don't really see. In contrast, of course, if there's a federal loan or a federal guaranteed loan, because that's a federal process, then we'd actually get to see whatever that is. And if there's tax changes in terms of property tax, we get to see what that is. But once you step into the private side of loans, that seems like we run into the same challenge we're already having about these are confidential, we don't get to see them. Am I missing something?
So confidentiality and disclosure can extend from public domain, which of course is full disclosure of all aspects that are put into public domain, through to company confidential, where information is not allowed to go outside of certain people within the company. And there's a range of levels of confidentiality within that. A disclosure structure that might apply in loan agreements and so forth may involve aspects of the project being disclosed to a limited group of parties under a non-disclosure agreement. And this is something that we're often involved in providing assurance to lenders, or assurance to our client. where commercially confidential aspects of the project are disclosed insofar as those are needed to provide assurance to, in my illustrative example, to lenders. And those kind of disclosure processes are acceptable to both parties, and they usually involve a an intermediary party like a law firm or a consultancy such as ours to receive and evaluate that information and prepare a report for the interested parties. So techniques like that are available, and I understand we're also used in SB 138. So that might be a way forward to provide information flow to the legislature without it being commercially compromising to the project proponents.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any other questions from the committee. I want to thank Mr. Fulford and Mr. Duncan for spending time with us today. It was a very robust presentation, lots of helpful information. This will conclude our meeting for today. The next meeting will be Wednesday, January 28th at 3:30. We're going to hear a presentation from the Department of Transportation related to the impacts from the gas pipeline project. And if there's time following that, you will hear again for a second time Senate Bill 180, LNG import facilities. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 5:23 p.m.